Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
Yes, welcome to the Retro Anatomy of a Movie, where we, the three of us here, take a movie that we should have seen at some point in our lives, but we haven't, and we take a look at it for the first time, and we pass the knowledge on to each and every one of you. This week, joined by myself, Christian Blatt, is joined by the wonderful, the talented, the happiest of cappiest.
The nicest thing Christian has ever said to me.
Don't get used to it, but
I am here, Alexa Cappiello. Woo!
And also, I forget now what I called you, lovely, talented, all those things. Also
yes,
true about Rachel.
Her.
Rachel Milano Cookie, also known as Rachel Goodman, Rachel Radner.
Rachel liked, the author.
Rachel liked Last Jedi more than I did, but
yes,
so did everybody.
or maybe not.
Rachel, hi.
Hi, I'm here.
Rachel Goodman. That's who yes. we go with, right? That's the appropriate branding?
That is, yes, that is my name.
And in the booth, Mr. Ryan J.
Woo!
Nielsen.
Ryan.
Hello, hello. Excited to talk about Invisible Man.
Now, Ryan, have you seen Invisible Man?
I have not seen Invisible
okay.
Man.
There's going to be some spoilers from 1933.
That's completely fine, because I'm really excited to see the new one coming out this Friday.
Yeah.
That, and I was going to mention that that's why we chose this one, because there is a new...
Invisible.
Nice. Okay, so it's okay to use music sometimes?
Oh,
that was some Queen Invisible Man for you.
That looks like that looks like Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah, they're very inspired
yeah.
by that.
Yeah.
Nobody looks better in a suit than Brian May. Anyway, we've got The Invisible Man, the original from 1933, that ties into the 2020 version that'll be starring Elizabeth Moss. I think this one's a little different.
Yeah.
Just slightly.
Just a little bit.
Yeah.
But, you know. Go ahead. What were you going to say? Rachel?
No, just that the Invisible Man that's coming out seems to be more centered around the Me Too movement and more about the psychological effects that somebody, first of all, beyond the grave has on a person still living, and how a kind of a stalker, egomaniac boyfriend can affect a person. So this was a little bit different.
It was a little bit different. And why do you think, Rachel, that you had not seen this movie up until this point in your life?
That's a really good question, because a long time ago I had read the book.
You felt like you knew the story.
I felt like I knew it and felt like, you know, honestly, maybe it was because certain movies, like I enjoy horror, but I also get very scared by horror. Not that I'd consider this to be a horror film per se, but
it is though.
It's got some scares and it's got
some death. A
lot more death than I expected.
A lot of death.
Honesty.
Yeah.
Yeah. It, very rarely do you think a movie from 1933, the title character is just an outright murderer.
Yeah.
And a very important thing about this movie, by the way, is that it's pre-code. It's before the Hays code.
Yeah. So somehow it passed that.
The fact that he's he's not a good guy. I would say he's a villain.
Yeah.
You know, and the movie's about him, and I think we're supposed to like him. I don't know that I ever come around to
we're
him.
We're supposed to kind of like him because he's doing this for his fiance, like out of love for her and like wanting to be or give her a better life
yes.
or whatever. But in reality, what you're really suggesting is, just to murder a lot of people for the greater good. Like it's very Thanos of.
Yeah, no, I agreed. And you know, look, it's a lot different than Kevin Bacon in Hollow Man. What he decided to be up to when he was invisible. So it just depends on what you do. Invisible power.
Basically, he wants to sell this idea, like this brilliant nugget of an idea, this potion that makes you invisible to whatever country will take it and then reap the benefits of that.
I mean, if you could have an invisible army, it would be pretty cool.
It would be.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't. I think about the money that you would save on uniforms, first of all.
Until they go incognito and they end up having a rebellion and uprise.
This is a terrible idea.
And there's also the problem if, is there going to be snow? Yeah, we can't use the invisible army.
No,
that's going to be a problem. Is it raining?
Yeah.
Yeah, again. Is there smog in the air? Yeah, that's going to also be a problem.
Now, I do want to point out, I know we're like laughing and everything right now, but just on a more somber note, the first thing that went through my mind watching this, the year 1933 is also the year that Hitler ended up taking power in Germany. So one of the things, one of the parallels that I instantly went to is that they were trying to show corruption and greed and what someone who is domineering and evil and foul in every way could be like. Obviously, they did not, like, World War II had not yet happened. There was no world war at this point, but I just found it very interesting that this would be one of the major grossing movies of that year.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, certainly in American history, you know, we were not very interested in what was going on anywhere outside of our borders. So, you know, there wasn't even really, didn't seem problematic in Germany. We're like, we already had the Great War. We took care of old Jerry. We took care of the Germans, so we don't have to worry about it anymore. Also, let's, you know, keep in mind that this is also before, I think this is actually the year that Prohibition gets repealed. So it's a very different time. The book was written in 1895, and I actually thought when the movie started that it was set in that time period. And then I saw the first car, and I was like, okay, so no, I guess it's just 1933. Mm-hmm. Feels like the late 19th century when you're watching it in 2020. You know, it felt pretty old. I mean, I guess when there was a telephone, I should have realized that it wasn't actually 1895.
But. And, I mean, I think it was the acting, too, and the way that I think that it's not so much that they obviously were in a film with English actors, but there was a certain... tone that actors used in this time period when they were in films, especially seeing a guy like Claude Rains. Mm-hmm. So it did age it for me.
Who has a voice like Butta, by the way?
I mean, it's like, a pretty great voice.
What a great voice.
Well, it was interesting, too, because I know him from Casablanca.
Yeah.
So seeing him so much younger at the very end...
he is a lot younger, you're right.
He was
12 years earlier, maybe.
This was one of his first movies.
Right.
I think Casablanca was 42, something like that.
So,
yeah.
Nine. Yeah. I just did that math. Thank you. You're welcome. but no, he is much younger, even though you don't see him until the very end.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's interesting. And let's talk a little bit about the cast. Gloria Stewart, I think, suffers from what the conventions were expected for actresses of this time. Remember, you didn't have sound in your film for very long at this point. The talkies, they all kind of talked the same way. And you're like, no one could have ever possibly talked like that. But yet everyone in movies does. And do you, either of you know what movie you've both certainly seen Gloria Stewart in?
Well, I know for a fact she was on a soap opera in 2002.
Okay. Like, do you know something else that you've seen her in?
No.
No.
Tell us.
Titanic. She's the old lady.
Oh, what?
Yeah.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I looked it up to make sure I was right. But I thought that was her name. Yeah. The old lady had to be somebody.
Well, I mean, because she, when I looked up her filmography, she had done a ton.
Yeah.
And it wasn't even only in the 30s. It was up until, you know, close to when she had passed away.
Gloria Stewart being the girlfriend?
Yeah, Flora.
Yeah, Flora. Who
I really feel like didn't have much of a role in this to begin with. So she was all right. She was just like...
Yeah, it was just like, well, you can calm him down.
Yeah.
You know? And by the way, not really.
Not really.
Not very effective.
No, she was just a pawn.
Yeah, just she's the only person he didn't want to murder.
Yeah, yeah. The only one. The only
literally
one that humanized him just a little bit.
Just, but barely.
Barely, I mean, though.
Yeah.
And
go ahead.
Yeah, the big thing with her, too, that, I mean, one, I, the way that I saw him with her, it did. I hoped that this would be the moment that we could see some kind of redemption, and that maybe it would actually be the monocaine, and we could argue, okay, well, he's only acting like this because of what the drug did to his brain. We don't know, though, if he was really already going crazy or if this was a byproduct of the drug, number one. But number two, I just wanted to make a comment about her and the Flora character and how it annoyed me that she pretty much cried in every scene.
Yeah,
and
she was...
I mean, you know, look, women be crying. I think that's a takeaway from you. But to be fair, there is actually kind of a lot to cry about when your fiance turns invisible.
Every scene.
Yeah, and you're, well, you know, and except you find out that he's probably, you know, like there's a chance he might murder you. And I think that it is very interesting, though, like from when he first shows up, you know, and he's at that inn. and he's just such a dick to everyone. Like, to everyone. I'm like, and he's not paying? Like, what? You know? And, I mean, obviously, we have the advent that we know that, you know, he's the Invisible Man. But I can imagine, like, audience like, well, this fellow's dressed rather odd. I wonder what his story is, you know, when you haven't read it.
Well, I'm sure they knew already based upon the fact that, yeah, I'm sure. it's like, for instance, if we go to see a movie and we have heard it's based on a book, I'm sure they understood that much, that it was about an invisible man.
The title does imply that might be the case. Yeah. There may or may not be an invisible person in this film.
I think that it was incredibly dramatic. The very first scene was so dramatic in that he walks in and everybody stops what they're doing to look at him. Like, it was very like those old Western movies where the guy walks in and then everybody gets quiet.
Or the modern day version of that, and you walk into, you know, an establishment and the record scratches and everyone stops to look at you. You know, I mean, that literally happens in 48 hours, a million other movies, but that's the first one I thought
That's
of.
Funny.
So yeah, there's definitely that, you know, and you know, he looks odd, but at the same time, it's snowing outside.
It's snowing.
So yeah, you could be bundled up. That's fine.
Yeah.
I did want to ask you, and Rachel, I know you've read it probably a while ago, but what comes to mind for you that are differences from, or is the book too long ago that you don't really remember what was different about it?
To me, it's been a long time, like back in high school, but from what I remember, it was similar. I feel like sometimes with the books, especially books written by H.G. Wells, sometimes you actually can see more of the character's perspective, like in any book in general.
Sure.
So I feel like, if anything, it was almost scarier watching the movie because you didn't have that perspective from the, I think his name was Jack. Yeah.
Jack Griffin.
My notes can tell you.
Let's hear some more from the notes. Alexa Capiello, Notemaster General of Retro Anatomy of a Murder.
Basically they say that Griffin was even more insane in the books. Griffin is already insane before he makes himself invisible, and he's entirely motivated by his lust for power in the book, as opposed to them giving him a little bit more of a humanizing motivation.
I would say a little bit more,
movie, where he's just trying to make a better life for his fiancé and him in the future. So,
see, it could just be that I read it a very long time ago, but I actually thought that he was worse in the actual movie. Because
interesting.
Because he sort of just jumped, like, as soon as he meets up with Kemp, he's all of a sudden like, yep, I want to, you know, kill a couple people and rule the world. No biggie.
And I need a visible partner, and it's the lucky day for you.
Kemp survives in the novel. His life is saved by those who ultimately kill Griffin. In the film, Kemp is terrified throughout and pays his life by betraying Griffin. With his life, excuse me.
That's what you get. Don't betray the invisible man.
Don't betray the invisible man. Who's like, I'm going to kill you on Saturday at 10 p.m.
He's got like a very, it's like, not right now, when I could just walk up and, I don't know, crush your windpipe. But I'll come back a little later.
Yep.
I don't have my killing gloves on, so at some point, don't worry, I will kill you. It's tonally very dark, obviously, because it's in black and white. It is visually very dark, but, you know, not necessarily, and not every black and white film feels quite as dark as this. But I do think that they do a good job sort of showing how desperate he is. Like, I mean, he's got this scheme but in the early part of the film, I think he really wants to be able to have a cure, not just so that he can sell it with a cure, but he's like, yeah, this invisible thing's been all right, but I think it'd probably be good if people could see me again, you know? So I'm just sort of wondering what each of you thought about sort of the little bit of the character arc we got for Jack throughout the movie. What did you think of, you know, basically as the movie went along, Alexa?
I don't know. I don't think it had a strong enough arc for him. Like, I wanted to like him more, and I just didn't. He was just a bad person. I didn't even care that, you know, his motivation was for his fiance. I just I don't know. I felt very disconnected from him. And
but to be fair, your heart is invisible, so yes. You don't actually know how to yes. feel that kind of.
Yes. Yes. No. I just for talking classic monster movies, I felt more when I watched Frankenstein than I ever did watching this. This I really enjoyed from a special effects standpoint, but story wise, I thought it was just okay. I didn't think it was strong in that regard.
What did you think about Jack Griffin?
I think he was supposed to have much of an arc mm-hmm. other than he's I think the whole point was that don't mess with science yeah. as much as he had. Yeah. And that was basically the mistake that he made that was going
don't
to
play
be
God.
That was going to be yeah. irreversible. And so, but here's the thing though. So for me, at first, I wasn't sure where they were going with this because I had no expectations that it was going to be anything like the book. I just kind of viewed it as watching something separate. And so as I was going into this, at first I thought it was going to be a comedy when we first saw Jack and he was kind of like, you know, running around in the room, chasing everybody out.
Naked, by the way.
Yeah.
Totally naked.
But nobody really got hurt, like super hurt. Nobody
not
got
at
to,
first.
Yeah, not at first. But it was the point when he went in and then killed an officer and walked out. Mm. That was the point where I said, okay, yeah, this guy has, there's no way to really redeem him. And then by the end, you know, by the time he's running around killing people on trains and just, you know, messing things up to a point where he really is just sabotaging yeah. everyone, that's where I'm like, okay, yeah, this really, like, I thought that at first they were going to have him go through an arc where he was able to become a better person mm-hmm. from being invisible. Mm-hmm. But then as soon as he started killing, I realized that is not the direction they were going. And if anything, I thought that Kemp might have had a stronger arc, but then he flatlined at a certain point. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I agree with all of that. And I do think that, you know, a little bit more complex storytelling would be that he would be redeemed, he would be a better person, but then gets killed anyway because yeah. everybody's like, yeah, but you did all that stuff, so yeah. We haven't stopped coming for you. Mm-hmm. So here's a pitchfork to the eye, buddy.
I also felt like their third act was really short. Now, I know the movie
was... it's an hour and 10 minutes or an hour and 15?
An hour and 11, yeah.
Okay.
There's only so far you can go with it, though. Yeah. Like, you know, if you're going to take the reins of making him this big murderer, like, how many murders do we get to see before it finally, like, okay, let's do enough.
Yeah, but like...
I wanted more murder in this movie.
The big climactic moment, though, when we were getting to that very end, it was only a span of, like, eight or 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. So I felt like we had all of this build up, and then we finally got to, like, the meat, and then it was over. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's very abrupt. Obviously, films were much shorter, especially at this point. But, yeah, I mean, it's funny because this is such a well-known, you know, it's hard to call this a monster movie, but he is considered sort of one of those monster characters.
It is a monster movie.
So, yeah, and I think you don't think of it being quite this short, you know? There's plenty of room to add commercials when you show it on television, so there's no problem there.
I actually thought it was one of the first superhero movies in the sense that there's a guy, unlike, you know, not too dissimilar from, you know, other... superheroes we know or villains who accidentally, you know, drop in some chemical or they take a medication. And so suddenly he became this evil, corrupt person from messing with a chemical. And everything that ensued was, it felt very formulaic to me and reminiscent of a superhero film.
I wish that they had, instead of blowing this up into like these big murder scenes, had taken more time to make it more of like a suspenseful, like given them a suspenseful scene, like where he's creeping up on people more and like doing things here and there. And like, you can't see him. So it's really scary. It's really scary when you can't see the villain.
Sure.
We know that from Jaws. So
very true.
So they should have built the suspense as opposed to just murdering people left and right. I don't know.
I agree.
You know what I mean?
And it's
they had the perfect opportunity to do so. Like all these little special effects they could have done. I don't know.
It's harder too when it's Claude Rains and he's going hee 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 every time.
It is hard to take them a little seriously. Yeah. You know, you're making the point that sort of one of the takeaways of this story is that, you know, we shouldn't really mess with science to this degree. And I'm glad that in the 80 plus years since this movie, we have clearly heeded that. And we as a society do not mess with science at
no
all.
Way.
We haven't cloned any sheep.
No.
We haven't invented breeds of dogs. We haven't figured out a way to make a tomato without seeds in it. We didn't do any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. So thank God that we learned the lesson that we should not play God and we should not mess around with the dark arts of science. So I think that it's you can see why this movie is important in a lot of ways. Like from a filmmaking standpoint, you're like, oh yeah, I mean, just sort of visually, you know, I mean, they clearly spent money on it, whatever big budget was in that point. And
it
I think
was
Alexa 300, Capiello,
yeah. 300,000, I think.
And
yeah.
Made over
328,000.
I mean, you can't make a McDonald's commercial for
$300,000. It's 71 minutes, and it was released in 1933.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, you were talking about the effects.
Yeah, the special effects.
I have read a little bit about this, but I find it fascinating how they did it, because now you could do The Invisible Man. We have a room in this building. I could go wear a green shirt in front of the green screen, and it would be very easy.
That's partially why I feel like this remake is not going to be good. I mean, I'm glad that they're, you know, the Me Too movement. I'm glad that they're, like, incorporating these things into this, you know,
take
film.
That microphone.
Smack.
Wait, did you do that, or did Claude Rains hit your microphone?
But it's just not the same. I think that this movie was made in 1933 for a reason, and the special effects, in my opinion, it wasn't about the story. I mean, you could take away certain things from the story, yes, but I think what really makes this film special are the special effects, what they were able to achieve back then.
Because if they weren't special, they would just be effects.
Right, correct. The cigarette stupid. Scene where he's...
I did like that.
That was cool. I'm like, yeah. Oh. I mean, like, I can obviously see that that's not... in the scene right here, but...
And then when they did it in the video
We'll talk about that. Okay. Yeah. I sort of want to talk about this film, and then we'll talk about invisible characters thereafter, but yeah. Yes. We're going to tease that forward, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, when Claude Rains had to take his clothes off, the effect was achieved by shooting Claude Rains in a completely black velvet suit against a black velvet background, and then combining the shot with another shot in the location of the scene took place using a matte process. Claude Rains was actually claustrophobic, so it was hard for him to breathe in the suit.
Which is great casting. Like in The Wizard of Oz, when the original Tin Man was allergic to the Tin Man makeup.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, yeah, we should have looked into that.
The work was difficult. And so they had a double who was somewhat shorter than Rains, but was sometimes used.
Well, if you're invisible, I guess it doesn't really matter how tall you are.
You know, it's great for continuity. Like, just make sure that he matches. Okay, so you mean the floating cigarette? Yeah, we got that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just insane what they were able to accomplish back then. And honestly, I would have preferred watching a behind the scenes about how they were able to do the special effects than the film itself. I'm glad I watched it.
It's not without, you know, first of all, it's not without entertainment value. And historically, there's a lot to be taken away from it. But yeah, I agree that like seeing how they were able to pull that off. I mean, that just seems so counterintuitive, like the black velvet suit.
I know.
And just, you know, I mean, but when you think about like what they were doing with film, I mean, it's like, I think in King Kong, they actually would scratch the negative to kind of get the look of like lightning or, you know, that era. And I think King Kong is maybe the same year as this. If not, it's right around 1933. So, you know, they did whatever they could think of, and it's just like, yeah, great, let's use this black velvet suit.
Yeah, well, and then also when he had his clothes on, they used wires, basically.
Yeah.
That's, like, so cool! They, like, hung it up by wires, and they moved it with wires. And then I was wondering how they did the opening and closing of doors and all that stuff. I don't know. It's probably not that difficult, but I was just like, oh.
Yeah, it's probably like a, you know,
that's
like a stagehand with a very large stick.
No.
I mean, I'm almost wondering, too, like, for example, with the floating books.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if, you know, obviously it wasn't... I didn't see a string, and sometimes with movies like this, you can tell.
Yeah.
I'm almost wondering if, for some of the effects, what they did was they filmed it with someone carrying it, and then they filmed another shot with no one in it at all, and then just kind of clipped the two, you know, the film together to give it that effect. But that would be, you know...
There is a mistake, though. At the very end, you know, when you see him walking through the snow, it should be footprints, but...
Because he can't wear shoes.
Bare footprints, they're shoe prints.
Yeah, because he can't wear clothes. Right. Yeah, I did read that. I did think it was a cool effect, though, even though they did get it wrong that they did it with shoes. like the idea that...
What if he made his shoes invisible, too? And whatever he was wearing is always going to be on him.
That's a bit of a workaround that they used for invisible characters. Like Sue Storm, the Invisible Girl / Invisible Woman from the Fantastic Four. It's like, oh, yeah, no, her costume's invisible, too. Yeah. You don't have to worry about that. That's fine. You know, I mean, it's. I think that invisible technology has come a long way since 1933. But I did think some of that stuff looked cool. It is interesting how they were able to figure out, it's like, well, we're going to just build this big wall, and we're going to put, you know, all this stuff at the top, and then we're going to see him. And then, you know, thank God that it snowed that day. Because I do have to say that it took me out of the story when he's sleeping on the hay, and he's sleeping.
Wow.
I'm like, really? That's how the Invisible Man sleeps? Wow. It was so loud. And I was just like, all right, I think that, you know, you can look at it how long ago that movie was, but really, like, that's how they're having him sleep.
Yep.
That and the fact that it was so...
Oh, I think he's snoring in me paws. Oh, I heard him. And I was like, yeah, of course you heard him. He's louder than anything else in the film.
The director, James Whale, does come from a theatrical background.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, that might fly in the theater, but not in the movie theater. What were we going to say? Right?
No, just that it's also awkward for me watching Kemp and the other... watching Kemp and the other cops trying to plan all of this and not recognizing it all. Like, they made one little passing comment, oh, he might be around. But then the fact that they would choose to make the rest of their plans in the same spot where the Invisible Man knows, they should have probably just figured out, okay, he was last sighted here by these people. Let's go, let's drive somewhere else where we know that he's definitely not, at least try.
But
not
how
to
do you
be...
know that he's not in your car?
Well, if you know that if you've already heard the news that he's somewhere else through phone, and it's not that behind, you can at least try to be somewhere else.
I mean, I like A for effort, trying to move the nets through the room, you know, and everybody, you know, trying to catch him, make sure he's not in there. But, doggone it, he just always found a way, that invisible man. He found a way to be invisible. Are there any other good tidbits before we talk more about this film in terms of its legacy and follow-ups and such? I mean, obviously, we do have the new version coming out, I believe, this Friday with Elizabeth Moss. And I actually don't know who's playing the Invisible Man in that. You know, it doesn't matter because he's invisible. But I know we'll see him at some point in the film. So if anything jumps out at you, Alexa, please chime in. Really, at any time.
Well, I mean, you guys know...
Not now! No, at any time.
The director, James Whale, also did Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein, and he was openly gay, which back in the day was very obviously taboo. But a lot of historians believe that Bride of Frankenstein was just basically a commentary on... social commentary on marriage and how Frankenstein reacted to his creator versus his bride, and all that is basically a way of James Whale to talk about sexuality and homosexuality and how marriage doesn't need to be between a man and a woman. It could be between a man and man or a woman and a woman.
An invisible man and a wolf man.
Yeah.
There's no, why should the universal monsters not have the same rights as everyone else?
Yeah.
The only other thing I want to mention too is the production. It was by Carl Laemmle Jr., who was actually, his father was Carl Laemmle, who founded Universal Studios. Mm-hmm. And his son, the junior, took over he took over until I think it was 1928, after his father had passed away.
Well, if only I knew somebody who worked at Universal Studios who might know something about him.
Yeah, Carl Laemmle, who is that guy? I do. I work at Universal. I'm a tour guide over there, so we get Carl Laemmle, jammed into our brains.
I've been to his movie theaters, so there's one right down the street, you know? Yeah. So there, do you talk about the Foundings or?
Yeah, of course. We do mention it on our tours, Carl Emley and his legacy and all that. So of course, it's a big deal.
So this is from the IMDb page for the movie, but I did want to share that the first time Claude Rains' daughter ever saw him, her father, in a movie was in 1950. He took her to a showing of The Invisible Man in a small Pennsylvania theater. Shout out for you, Rachel. While the movie was playing, he kept telling her about how he made the movie. So everyone stopped watching the movie and just paid attention to Claude Rains talking about how they made the movie. So if you had been in that theater in 1950, you could have found out about the behind the scenes, Alexa. So there are obviously follow-up films that are not actually attached to this. There's obviously that character does die at the end, which I think is like kind of like a – I think that's one of the things that they do best is that reveal that we don't see photos of him. There's not like a painting of him. There's – we don't actually – I mean, yes, if you know what Claude Rains looks like, sure. But you don't see him until the very end, and I think that that's kind of like a cool reveal. I also wonder – how annoying it would be if you never actually got to see him. He's like, and now he's dead.
He was, here's a good fun fact. He was supposed to be Boris Karloff, or Boris Karloff was supposed to play.
He was supposed to play the Invisible Man.
But they had a mix up in directors and Karloff decided not to be in it because, they were messing with his salary. They didn't want to give him.
Yeah, they probably wanted to give him like $100, and he's like, "I insist on $105."
Boris Karloff's like, "Dude, I was Frankenstein, man. You need to step it up."
Yeah.
Plus, why are we using the same actor over and over again in every single monster role?
They should have told him that Bela Lugosi is going to work for half of your rate, and he's like, "I'll do it." So. Invisible Man appears with, I think that's the one with Vincent Price. There's no shortage of Invisible Man movies. There are multiple Invisible Man TV series, one from 2000, one from, I think, 1950. So this idea of invisible characters is fairly prevalent.
Wasn't there one with... Not Kevin Spacey.
Kevin Bacon. That one's called Hollow Man.
Oh, okay.
So you didn't have to license anything.
Which, by the way, you can watch our Guilty Movie Pleasures coverage of Hollow Man tomorrow at 6 p.m. PST.
Oh. Look at that. Cross-promotion.
That's convenient.
The thing about Hollow Man is I think they achieved what I wanted out of this movie, which
you
was...
You wanted it to be more rapey.
No. Not rapey, but suspenseful.
No, I know.
It was scarier as opposed to just...
Well, I think that you have to understand this is probably very scary for 1980.
All right, fine. But yeah. I wanted more suspense.
Yeah.
No, I actually think it was just the time period.
Yeah.
I think that seeing this, especially back then when the effects were so limited, it was probably one of the scariest movies that people had ever seen.
Right. Yeah, no, I think you're probably right. And then just that idea of like, wait, is there an invisible person in this theater sitting next to me?
A ghost?
I don't know. Before we move on to talk a little bit more about The Invisible Man, I think we should actually get to what we talk about on every episode of this show. Does it hold up? Rachel, does it hold up?
I would say yes. The reason being, it held my attention. Did I think that the third act was a little bit lacking? Yes. But if I'm holding it to a 1933 standard... Then no, I don't think that I don't think there was anything wrong with that act being so short, and it felt very satisfying for me at the end. And I think that we saw the Invisible Man die; he had to die, and so just throughout, it was a very entertaining watch. And so I would say, yeah, all these years later, it still holds up.
Well, not judging it from a 1933 standard, Alexa, from the 2020 standard.
Yeah, that's what I thought we were doing with this question, which is taking it...
No, you're saying the third act isn't really a problem, and you do feel that the movie holds up.
It holds up even now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But what do you think, Alexa?
I'm close to saying yes, but I'm more like, nah, not really.
I'm inclined to agree in that sense that it holds up in the way of like... You have to watch it through a very specific prism.
Very specific lens like, and understand the time period. And
like old television.
Give it benefit of the doubt.
That is very often the case. You know?
So I don't think, if by 2020 standards, I don't think people would go to this movie and say, that was a really good movie. I think they'd be like, that was all right.
It was like, okay, I guess. Yeah,
yeah, so no,
I do think it's all of its significance is in it being historical and it being from such a long time ago. I think... it doesn't hold up for a modern audience that's going to just walk in and see it. But if you enjoy film and studying film, you're going to like it.
Yeah. And I do think it's overall very entertaining, even watching it now. But I agree. I don't think that it's not going to draw an audience that a movie like Invisible Man with Elizabeth Moss is going to draw.
Right. And
I'm a little intrigued now. I think I'm intrigued. Yeah. I think I'm going
to
see it.
Yeah. Well, you can tell me how it was. No, it's more because I don't get out to the movies very much. I have to watch my movies at home.
You don't go out to the movies, and yet you are hosting an Anatomy of a Movie show.
Retro Anatomy of a Movie. Where can
He's calling himself old.
Where can I watch these movies? In my house. Once my kids go to sleep. And I just want to give a shout out. I shared a video with each of the ladies. For me, my first exposure to The Invisible Man came in a very little known film called Amazon Women on the Moon. And it has a very funny sequence starring Ed Begley Jr. as The Invisible Man. And I'm using air quotes for The Invisible Man. Because he's actually not invisible, but he thinks he's invisible. And everybody's just gotten used to the idea of like, oh no, help me, checkers moving. And, you know, it's just, they're like, he just thinks that he's like pulling a fast one, everybody. And meanwhile, he's just this naked guy walking around. And I was thinking when I was putting together my notes for this, the reason why I'm mentioning it is I'm like, oh yeah, and then there's The Son of the Invisible Man. I'm like, oh wait, that's not a real movie. That's Ed Begley Jr. in Amazon Women on the Moon. I don't quite know what that Invisible Man is that Ryan's showing.
Moss. It's the new one.
Oh, that's for the new one. All right. Yeah. I didn't know who that was a photo of because she's almost invisible. So that is our coverage on Invisible Man. For next week, I wanted to pick a sports film because of the upcoming
Sports Ball.
The Way Back, I believe, is the name of the Ben Affleck movie. And instead of just, you know, picking a gem from Ben Affleck's, you know, maybe Phantoms or something that most people haven't seen. Instead, I thought we would dive into arguably, or by some people's account, one of the greatest sports movies ever made, Brian's Song. So we will watch that next week on a retro Anatomy of a Movie. I almost left the retro off. But until next week, Rachel, where do people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Rach Goodman or on my author Instagram account at Rachel Radner Author. You can also find me on The Outlander, The Young and the Restless, Narcos Mexico Season 2, Curb Your Enthusiasm, and the Stumptown panels.
You left off Doctor Who.
Oh, and, well, one more.
Season finale.
One more.
People can watch it. And, you know, the reason why you really have to watch the Curb Your Enthusiasm panels is we're both on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The other ones, sure. But we're both
maybe
on that one.
And I am chopped liver.
You're on this show with us, so tune in next week.
I'm actually patiently waiting for Barry to come back.
Still not back.
I know. But yeah. My name's Alexa Cappiello, and you can find me on Instagram at Alexa Cappy, C-A-P-P-Y.
Don't look for her anywhere else. The only place you need her is Insta. And you can find me, Christian Blatt, on Twitter and Instagram at ChristianDMZ. And amongst the other shows that I do, in addition to Curb Your Enthusiasm, Thursday is at 9 Pacific, Star Trek Picard after show. We've got a few more weeks of that, so tune in there. But again, that is all the time we have, so we will see you next week at the movies.
See you later.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
Views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.